This is tape number 7, side 1 of the oral history interview with Professor Joe Elder. You were talking about being in My Lai.
Right, and the two helicopter pilots who actually spotted Solar Massacre going on, Hugh Thompson and Larry Colburn were the names, and Hugh Thompson had directed the helicopter to land between where American troops were pursuing some civilians from My Lai. And it had instructed the Americans to stop pursuing them and told Larry Colburn to train his gun with the Americans.
Wow.
For a 19-year-old kid, that was a strange order.
Boy, I'll say.
They called down some Huey helicopters, the bigger ones. They picked up the 7 or 8 fleeing villagers and took them to Quang Dai, the nearest province, where actually our hospital had been at that time, Quang Dai. And then as Hugh Thompson and Larry Colbert were lifting off in their little bubble helicopter, they saw some movement in the trench, went back down, found a little boy, maybe 7 years old, who was alive under all these bodies, picked him up, put him on their lap, and flew him to Quang Dai. And then Hugh Thompson reported what he'd seen to our officials and was given a stone wall for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, eventually, just a month or so before we went out, the Army had finally recognized both of them for you know, both got a Silver Star, I think, for essentially doing what you're supposed to do in these situations, you know, refusing an order which is a violation of the Geneva Agreement. So they were feeling somewhat exonerated for what happened. And the major event here was people had tracked down what had happened to the kid. Now, he had been orphaned by the massacre. He'd been sort of raised on his own. He'd become a delinquent. He was in prison. And they found somebody who was willing to sign. The man is now, what, 30-some years old. Sign him out, give him a job. And I was there when Hugh and Larry met him.
Huh.
Really something. Yeah, very powerful. And
wonderful.
Larry had his 9-year-old boy with him. So there was Larry and his 9-year-old. Anyway. Huh. The kind of thing that is hard to picture. Either. So that was a powerful revisit, and mostly just seeing stuff. The schools going up and the peace parks being built. And Mike goes over almost every year for 2 or 3 months, working on the Mike Rowland project and trying to get the schools built and so. So we're not. I'm not disconnected from Vietnam. So, but Mike Bain is the chief link in this 501c3 thing called Madison Quakers Inc.
Have you read David Marinus's They Marched into Sunlight?
Bits and pieces of it. It was run in the papers for a while. This is some years
ago.
Yes, and you know, it's all there. It was clear on the campus that I was involved in things like the anti-war activity. And several other sorts of things I was doing. Subsequently, I was involved in Quaker activities, carrying messages in other parts of the world. At one point, an effort to do something with the Bangladesh conflict. And I got involved in 1984 with carrying messages between the Tamil Tigers and other Tamil resistors, the government of Sinhala, and that was an ongoing thing for a long, long time. So occasionally, stories got picked up about the kind of thing I was doing. So I guess I was identified as a person who was actively involved in trying to do things that reduced conflict. So when 9/11 happened, and it was stunning, shocking, and appalling to all of us, I had the same kind of sick feeling I think everybody else did about that. So there was an announcement that there was going to be a prayer and memorial service at the Library Mall that Friday after the Tuesday. And I hadn't even planned to go. I wasn't quite sure how that would help things at all. And then it was Thursday, I got a call from someone in the chancellor's office asking if I would talk to this gathering. And it had never occurred to me, you know, to be a speaker at this. I wasn't a prominent university official or something like this. And it would be the Dane County and the university. So it seemed to be the mayor or some prominent person. So I was a little puzzled that they called me. And at the point, my response was pretty dumb. I said, well, I have a dentist appointment. I don't think I can make it. And whoever at the other end says, well, do you think you could break your dentist appointment? And at that point, it occurred to me, maybe all the stuff that I've been through could give a message of some kind. And so fairly briefly, I called and said, I cancel my dentist appointment and try to figure out what I would say. And it occurred to me at that point that the fact that I had been to memorial services about following the deaths of innocent civilians gave me kind of a story to tell. And so in the talk, which I gave in front of what was said to be the largest assembled crowd in university history, I mentioned what had happened and put it into context. So if I could just read from my statement.
Please do.
Last Tuesday, September 11, 2001, those of us watching television saw something we had never seen before. The deaths of thousands of our fellow human beings trapped inside the World Trade Center in Manhattan as the towers crumbled to the ground. We're here today to reflect upon and remember those who died in that tragedy and the parallel tragedies in Washington, D.C. and the countryside near Pittsburgh. The violent death of a single innocent person is a tragedy. The violent death of thousands of innocent people strains the human heart. Today we join with millions of others gathered today throughout the land and overseas to share our grief and to extend our sympathy and support to the families and friends of those who died. And here's the part that I felt my personal history on. This is the third time in 3 years that I have participated in a memorial service for the victims of terrorism. 3 years ago, in a village in Chiapas, Mexico, I stood with the relatives and friends of dozens of women and children who had been killed by paramilitary forces while they were worshiping in a nearby chapel. There were flowers and pictures of the dead. 6 months ago, in Vietnam, halfway around the world, I stood with the relatives and friends of hundreds of fellow human beings whose lives had been snuffed out in a single morning of horrible violence. There were flowers and pictures of the dead. Each of these memorial services has been different in terms of loss of life. The earlier two memorial services pale, but not into insignificance. In each case, the lives of innocent people ended cruelly and permanently. In each case, the perpetrators of the killings have remained at large. In each case, the call for justice has gone unanswered. And then I sort of conclude. Perhaps from this tragedy, we with other nations can build institutions that will prevent future acts of terrorism and will apprehend and bring to justice those involved in acts of terrorism. Perhaps from this tragedy, we can develop effective means of discovering the root causes of terrorism and address those root causes. Perhaps as an outcome of the tragedy, with the application of reason, patience, wisdom, and compassion, we can, with the other nations of the world, build cultures and institutions that will prevent a recurrence, not only in the United States, but anywhere in the world, of what happened Tuesday, September 11, 2001. Perhaps we can work together to build a world where there will be injustice. Then the section that where I do make some sort of a prescription as to how we might go about. Okay. Today we remember those who died last Tuesday. We pray that they did not die entirely in vain. In this tragedy, we, with other nations of the world, can build a web of information sharing that will make it impossible for terrorists to perpetrate similar tragedies in the future. Perhaps, despite the pain of this tragedy, we can abide by our national principles that individuals are innocent until they're proven guilty, that those who are guilty are to be punished, not their relatives, not those who speak the same language, not those who come from the same ethnic background, not those who share the same religious affiliation or live within the same national boundaries, wherever those boundaries may be. As our national leaders have repeated during the past several days, each of us has an obligation to protect from harassment or worse, those among us here in Madison and elsewhere in the United States whose language, ethnic background, or religion makes them targets of abuse by our fellow Americans looking for someone or some group to blame and punish. And let's protect the innocent from being blamed and punished. We can understand that some among us are calling for war in the belief that a war of retribution will bring us comfort. At times like this, we must remember that nothing kills innocent civilians like wars. Let us not kill innocent civilians in an effort to punish those who kill innocent civilians.
Joe, turning to another area of service, and this was focused, I think, it's pretty much on campus, was your key role in advocating for gay and lesbian and bi and transgender students.
Right. The first time I was even aware, well, The very first time I was really issued was, again, through the College Year in India program.
Huh.
I had never met a gay student.
Huh.
And back, probably in the early 1960s, there was a student I'd selected on the program, and he started to meet, and he said he was gay, and I sort of blinked. I thought I knew what that meant, but he was telling me something that I thought should be pretty private. And he was not only gay, but he wanted to study homosexuality in India.
Huh.
And my English told you, we'll study whatever there's to study. So we put him on to studying a group of men in India who dress as women. Sometimes they castrate themselves, sometimes they just want to dress like women. Sometimes they are polysexual, their organs are multiple or not there or something. They're called hijras, and they crop up in history, and you meet them periodically. They look like men dressed like women. So anyway, he went off and he did his fieldwork project, and that was the first project I had done. And he was an impressive guy, very thoughtful, very bright. But the first, person who said, "I'm gay." Well, after that, there were a couple of other students I met on the program, and I was amazed at how quickly they would come out to me and say this, because it still seemed this thing I don't tell people about.
Yeah.
But they wanted me to know, and wanted me to be comfortable about it, and okay. The first time it became administratively tricky was when I was on the board of the American Friends Service Committee. And this would have been probably early 1970s or something, where the issue of having minority representation on the board was becoming more and more, we have blacks and all the rest, but we were supposed to select candidates for the board and make sure that we had two candidates who were gay or lesbian.
Oh.
And they had to be Quakers. Well, you've never seen a more puzzled executive committee in your life. We sat there with this directive, and at that point I did not know a single Quaker who was gay, much less a Quaker of the kind of stature that you want to put onto a board that makes some critical decisions with the $4 million budget and the Quaker reputation and all the rest. It was just hilarious. We try to think of people and every stereotype. Well, she didn't ever marry, do you suppose? He likes music with that. Flattery in the dark on this kind of thing. And we had to make phone calls. And how do you find out? Well, just pick you up and say, Jim, are you gay? We're a gay Quaker. So we eventually worked it out, but it struck me. Several things struck. First of all, that obviously if there are people who are gay and lesbian and they are Quakers, they should have a voice in the board of directors. But how do you go about finding them when it's such a huge secret and there's such a stigma attached to it? So that was, I guess, the first time. And then gradually I did begin to learn that there were several Quakers, and often prominent Quakers, and often sort of surprising that these were people who had been closeted most of their life or just, had been comfortably gay or lesbian themselves and just not make a big deal out of it. So after that, I was aware of people's kids coming out to them, and it became a phenomenon, it was happening. And then the son of one of our close friends came out as gay, and then it didn't occur, what would happen if one of our kids turned out to be gay? Oh, very abstract and very in principle, just fine.
Well, uh-huh.
That's what they want. So when our son came out to us, it was not a total shock, although I had not seen the signs. I had not been aware. He was tall, good-looking, girls were always chasing him. He was a member of a folk dance group. He had lots of girlfriends, lots of boyfriends. But it wasn't until he finished college in Earlham that he said that he was gay, and he figured he was gay for a long time. So it wasn't a shock at that point. It just, now it's the person we really know.
Hard for you? Or?
It was remarkably simple.
Uh-huh.
It's still, okay. That explains why you don't go out with all these girls who are chasing you.
No.
That explains it. And we began to read a whole lot more about what happened. Is it related to the father is away and the mother is overbearing and all the kind of stereotypes that were there? We fairly quickly got involved in Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it was just beginning to emerge. And once we saw we were in this for good, then let's sort of be there for other people. So it was interesting coming out. At one point, we were going to go public here because of some parents and friends thing, and then we got to check with our son Ed and make sure he was okay. He said, oh, sure, you want to tell people? So that it gradually became increasingly comfortable to talk to people. And the final thing, I guess, my parents, who are missionaries, we weren't very eager to have them find out about it. And I remember I dropped several hints to my mother in her late 80s or early 90s that Ed was, he went to gay groups and so on. And finally she came right out and said, well, is he gay? And I said, yes, Ed has told us he's gay. And then she said, is that okay? And I said, yeah, it's okay. She said, well, then that's fine. That took care of my missionary mother. She said, okay. The place I connected on campus was hearing about the ROTC unit and the fact that it was now under fire because it refused to admit gays and lesbians.
Mm-hmm.
I heard it, I guess it was, I heard on the radio that it was being questioned. And as soon as I found out that it was, they did discriminate on the ground, I thought this is, in a sense, too hypocritical. Because we have a state that doesn't discriminate, we have a city that doesn't discriminate, we have a campus that doesn't discriminate. And then we have these three federally funded organizations with all the stature and reputation they have who do. So I watched the debate. I was not on any committee at that time. There was a student investigation, a committee to look into what should be done, and the committee came back with a recommendation that although disaffiliation was an extreme step, at least all the people involved should be aware and sensitive and report, and the kind of stuff that committees tend to do. And that struck me as not acceptable. This wasn't going to just go away to have this blatant hypocrisy here. And anyway, I've always had a grudge against the military.
Yes.
And a suspicion that ROTC shouldn't be on campus. If we're teaching people to train to think critically and then they're being told to obey, it seems a little bit contradictory. And they get credits for what they do, and that's not the same as giving credit for physics or for science or anything. So I didn't have a love for the ROTC. This was one more reason to be critical of them, but kind of on ethical grounds. So when it looked as though it was going to die with an annual report from the committee saying nothing much can be done, then there were several faculty, and I didn't know gay or lesbian faculty at this point either, whom I came to know later were gays or lesbians.
Huh.
They came, and we decided that we would have, try to collect 200 signatures from faculty members to have an all-faculty meeting, because the Senate takes care of decisions unless you can get 2,200 faculty to sign, and then there must be a general faculty meeting to vote over the issue.
And general faculty means all faculty?
All faculty, all 1,000 plus, whatever we are. So we discovered that it didn't take long at all to get 200 faculty signatures. And by that time, it was fairly clear that there was going to be a meeting. This was in spring of 98, I think. I should have that date somewhere. And when there was going to be a formal meeting, it was going to be, I think, in December. Why don't you kill the tape recorder just a moment? So beginning in essentially the spring of 89, we got together the necessary votes. And the decision was that there would be an all-faculty meeting the next fall, which was indeed held on December 4th, 1989. And the vote had to do with whether the faculty would request the Board of Regents to terminate the university's contracts with the Army, Navy, and Air Force ROTC programs if those programs did not end discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation by May of 1993. The date there wasn't so the students who'd come here planning their finances through ROTC would be all the way through, but there wouldn't be a new batch started. Since I had more white hair than anybody else, I was the person who led the debate, and I actually do have a videotape of the whole thing if anybody's ever interested in it. And the vote was taken. There was a vigorous debate. Chancellor Shalala, I guess that's where I brought her in. She mm-hmm. was very eager that it be done in a dignified fashion and that the Wisconsin come out looking good no matter what happened. And the vote was in favor of asking the Board of Regents to terminate 386 to 248. Well, the Board of Regents didn't terminate, and the decision then was to, well, the committee was set up, and at that point, Donna had sort of spotted me and several others as the ones who were concerned about this, So from then on, I've always been on some committee or other, the task of which is to make this a friendly campus for lesbians and gays.
Joe, when you say a vigorous debate, were you surprised at the tenor in terms of, was there a lot of homophobia, or was it more about ROTC?
I was surprised at how much support I obviously had. I had gone in with two resolutions. One was sort of a watered resolution, which I thought might pass, and the other was a hard-cutting resolution. And in my presentation, I sort of presented these two and said, we are first going to, I think I said, we're first going to ask for this, which probably won't pass, and then we're going to ask for this. And almost immediately, the audience said, forget the second one, let's go for the hard one. So at that point, I realized that there really seemed to be a majority here. I had no sense of taking a pulse of what was going on. And then it was clear as the debate proceeded that the other side had no moral grounds to stand on. They could stand on sort of expediency, well, they're here and people have scholarships and we have contracts. But at each point, the clear collision between a state, a campus, and a city that say one thing and somebody's violating and getting off without even having a wrist slap just seems impossible. So when the vote was taken, I wasn't surprised that we had it, but I would not have bet that we were going to have it when we started. I had no way of telling from the mood of the faculty. And the heavy hitters, the university committee, which is the elected executive board of faculty, were very much opposed to this. Don Nichols was the chief.
Really? Yeah. Opposed to the resolution?
No, they said, this is unrealistic. We need the units here. There's something in the contract of the University of Wisconsin that's obliged to train officers. And they went back to the charter. We read the same thing and said, but you could read that as, you don't have to have an ROTC unit, you just have to have some courses.
Because we're a land grant.
So in the process of training students, we had to train them in some form of defense, but that could be a lot of stuff besides being in the Army, Navy, or Air Force. So it was an interesting campaign to work on. We learned a lot about the rules of the university. And here, the fact that Donna let us work with the university lawyer, who I later learned was gay, which I hadn't realized.
Oh, really?
This thing just gets sort of unfolded. So once there, then came Bill Clinton, then came Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and technically the issue is sort of off the back burner. You don't have to sign now when you go into the ROTC, but you're pretty sure that at some point you probably won't be allowed to be armed forces, although if you can conceal your identity, you still could technically do it. So anyway, it wasn't any more a clear issue. Then there was the faculty senate appointed a committee to be concerned about the friendliness of the campus or the LGBT issues, and I've been on that committee virtually from its founding, and I was chair of it for the last 6 or 7 years anyway.
Is there going to be, or is there a gay studies department?
We have a certificate program, which we got going about 2 years ago, so people can take a basic course, which I teach.
And oh, you do?
That's right. We did get on the ground floor. This was funny, because in the list of things that we came, in 1997, we came up with a statement of we need to do these, 18 things to make the campus good. There's the orientation and dormitories and options and this and that. And built into it was at some point there should be courses. And as far as we knew, there's only one course given by a woman in the philosophy department on lesbian philosophy, and that was it. Well, Dick Keeling, who was the chair of the department and was head of the student health services and himself gay, and I would sheepishly look at each other every time we said there should be courses. Yeah, somebody should teach a course. And finally, our consciences got the better of us. And Dick had a very bright senior working for him who was a gay man. And so Rich assigned the student to develop a course. Readings, all the rest. There's Bob O'Brien, and he did a great job. He got 3 credits for designing the course, because neither Rich nor I had any time to cook up a course or do a whole lot of reading. So we got it through the divisional committee, so that it's both the social science and the humanities course, and it's a 200-level course, so freshmen can take it. And then the fall before we were to teach it, and I think I do have it here, we were going to start The fall of 1999, we were all set thinking about ordering the books, and Rich told me that he had a fantastic job offer in Manhattan where he was to be the director of a wide education program on general health and sexuality for the city of Manhattan, as far as I could tell. And so he was going to leave, which meant that I had to teach the course. So in the spring of 2000, for the first time, I taught the course called Introduction to Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Studies. And I was running from day one. I brought in as many specialists as I could from all over the place, especially the people in biology and psychology and areas like that, which I didn't know much about. The room was filled. We had no idea what kind of audience we had. And each year, depending on the size of the room filled up, so there was no doubt that we'd have any number of students. We pretty much have decided 200 is about the number that we can work out. So last year, for the first time, the sociology department gave me 2 graduate student TAs, which helped a lot, because now we have discussion sections. So it sort of is a fully going course. It's listed, cross-listed in sociology, women's studies, and inter-LNS, which is a non-department for everything that is a catch-all that doesn't fit quite someplace else. We introduced a certificate course by having to come up with the introductory level course, 12 additional courses from which they can pick 3, I think, and then a capstone seminar and so forth. And we just barely put enough courses together, even as we submitted it to the next higher up. We have a feeling this is just squeaky. We need many more courses. I was, surprised at how few courses there are. When I began comparing LGBT studies on other campuses, and we see sometimes they have 20 courses, 25 courses from various departments, and we're way behind the curve here with what we're teaching.
Is that academic inertia, or is it a reflection of what kind of reaction the legislature would have?
I don't think it's the legislation. I think it's the academic endeavor. When you arrive here, your big job is to get tenure.
Right.
And if there aren't sort of ongoing courses, it's a little risky to introduce something that I think is as far out as this. So if I were coming here in the history department, I would want to teach main history courses until I had my tenure, and then I might think of the history of the gay movement in the 20th century in the United States or something like that. So I think it's a case of getting people now who are well informed and are willing to teach courses after they get their tenure. Because several faculty have come in during the last 5 or 6 years who are very good, who are themselves gay or lesbian or allies. And I'm looking forward to the day where there will be courses on French gay literature and gays in the military and whatever else one wants, or any number of courses, or the media. I have something to do with the LGBT issues in the media. It would be a wonderful course.
And as a sociologist, I'm interested in your observations about the climate in the country today, relate when the issue of homosexuality surfaces in all of its many forms. What is your take on what's happening in America?
We're in the process of a radical shift in attitudes. It may not be as radical and fast as I'd like, but when I'm talking to students, it just is a non-issue. I'll ask students at what point they were aware they were gays or lesbians, and typically third grade, they know about it. And almost all of them say, well, what's the problem? If they want to marry, it's their business. If I want to marry what I want, it's my business. And so the group in class is almost a whole different culture from their parents or their grandparents, who look at this thing as appalling and somewhere akin to mating with animals and whatever else one wants to. So on one hand, I'm impressed, like what's happening in Wisconsin right now with the legislature trying to get this bill passed a second time and then out for a referendum, which well may mean that anything that looks like even a parallel of a marriage would be impossible. You couldn't have a domestic partner. Then really backwards from where people would move forward to the next generation, which is just can't figure out why the older generation is the least bit upset about this. So on one hand, I feel confident it's just a case of the older generation dying. It'll take care of itself. On the other hand, the older generation can make a lot of trouble, as it's doing right now in Wisconsin, by coming up with regulations that punish people for having other sexual orientations or making it extremely difficult or harassing them or making them second-class citizens, a whole series of things which they seem to feel obliged to in terms of their sense of ethics or their sense of what is natural or right.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Joe, I'm interested in hearing some of your observations about the future of higher education and how you see the UW in decades ahead. And I'm also interested in your observations on how the student body has changed during your 40-some-odd years here.
Okay. When I first came, I was coming from Oberlin College.
This is side two, tape seven. The October 17th oral history interview with Professor Joe Elder. Joe, you were talking about when you first arrived on campus.
Yeah. And I've been with Oberlin students who are very good and found, especially in the survey, freshman and sophomore courses, a lot of students who were clearly not of the quality in Oberlin. But there were always some who were of the quality. In the intervening years, what I've noticed is that the poor students have more or less disappeared from the campus. Hmm. I think it's been a deliberate policy. When I first came, I think it was the case that if you had a B average anywhere in the state, you could get into the UW. It was very non-competitive. And there was a kind of slaughterhouse the first semester where the effective figures that I remember were something like of the freshmen who came, less than 40% would graduate.
Wow.
The rest would just get chewed up in the process. It was the great democratic approach. Now, since then, the standards have gone higher. It's more difficult to get in. And the last figures I saw, one of these speak to the Baskin Hill Society things, was that it's pretty close to 90% or more freshmen who come in who will, if you give them 5 years, they'll get through something.
The extra year.
The extra year makes a difference. So it's more selective, you have fewer casualties along the way, and where there are casualties, it's probably as much finances and stuff like that as it is the students' inability to do so. So that just means students are much less problematic. In terms of their kind of idealism, I'm sure that the kind of courses I teach and the position I put myself into means that I meet students who are ultimately optimistic, ultimately believe in sort of the goodness of human nature, believe their progress is possible, groan about bad things that happen. And so I'm not sure this is across. I barely know any students who are members of the fraternities and sororities. That's just a reflection of where I happen to be. There are experimental campus units. There's the Bradley Hall, this freshman dormitory, which I've been in from the beginning and encouraged to get started. There's the international learning community, which I was in on the ground floor and helped get it started, so I'm a faculty fellow there. So I meet these students once a week in small groups, and they're just like the best students I've had in the past in terms of, you know, idealism and wanting to make a dent in the world and go out and do great things and join the Peace Corps and all this sort of stuff. So I've never felt that kind of sagging thing, which I know some of my colleagues have felt, that the world today is full of students who are me first and just looking for the professions and want the big house and the gigantic car and the long vacation. So I can't speak for the whole campus, but that set of students keeps coming through. I meet them in the Integrated Liberal Studies program, which I became involved in the 80s, and that's been a place where I've been able to bring in certain new courses that weren't there. These are students who choose to join a program where the effort is to make sure the disciplines crisscross, and so you're taking a social science, but it's not just sociology, you're taking biological science, it's not just botany. So I think that's, in a sense, perhaps insulated from the great crowd out there. But I find there are challenges and idealism all the way through that hasn't changed a whole lot since we've been there. It's frustrating now because with what's happening in Baghdad, there's this great sort of sense of pessimism. Almost the same thing that existed for so long in the Vietnam War, where it just looked as though nothing was going to change. You could parade, you could protest, you could do all kinds of things, but we were there for the long haul. But I have met almost no students who are saying anything other, how did we get into this mess, and is there any way that we could avoid doing it in the future? And to the extent I find people appalled, it's that we could so quickly be, we, the United States, could so quickly be reproducing the mistakes that led us into Vietnam, you know, the dishonesty, the assumption that people were going to greet us with open arms, mm-hmm. the notion that we have the answers to whatever's going on, and the idea that if we simply deceive and tilt things long enough, they'll work out somehow. Because the gap between what we're being told and what comes back from people who are in Iraq or in Afghanistan is just night and day in terms of what's actually going on.
Correct. Absolutely.
Right.
And what about the role of higher education in society, Joe? What do you think about it these days?
It's here and it's absolutely needed. I didn't realize how much intellectuals are needed. It sounds weird, but decisions are being made all the time at various levels, financial leaders, by voters, and so on, with information which often is partial or incomplete or just wrong. And the first time I felt kind of called upon to be an intellectual with information came around the time of the first Gulf War. I was out of the country at the time. I was making my annual visit to South Asia. And I heard there was going to be a big rally against the build-up for the Gulf War. And they wanted a professor to give a lecture on this, to be the main speaker. Mm. I thought, well, I don't know much at all about Kuwait or Iraq. That's not my beat. My beat is India. And yet when I came back, I had about a week to prepare this thing. There was going to be a big rally, and a lot of people going out there looking for justification for denouncing what the U.S. was doing. And at that time, as in the Vietnam War, I realized that the people who think and read and organize ideas so they can be weighed in the balance are in short supply. In Vietnam, at a certain point, John Smale in the history department had sat down and put together a series of things we call position papers, about 10 of them. We began with an argument by the administration for why we should be doing what we're doing. And then we spent about 2 paragraphs knocking it out. It's a very powerful form of argumentation. You take the strongest point and just say, here it's full of
currency.
Now, I learned a great deal because Southeast Asia is not my beat and Southeast Asia was John's beat. But it was as though we were giving water to the thirsty, because here were people who sensed the war was awful, but they were being given all these statements about dominoes and people only understanding violence and, you know, the stuff that justifies doing this sort of thing. And here came the evidence that this wasn't the case, that it wasn't, these weren't all dominoes, that Laos is different from Vietnam, and Vietnam's different from Thailand, and Thailand's different from Cambodia, and you can't assume these are all one thing or another. So the role of the intellectual as a thinker, a data gatherer, and a provider of this information for people who then often are willing to write letters and protest and vote and all the rest is something that I hadn't realized. And then there aren't a whole lot of people doing it. One time when I was amazed, we were going to have a meeting of the Madison Institute, which is a small think tank I'm a member of. And we wanted to have a presentation about Robert La Follette, the great liberal thinker. We couldn't find anybody in the political science department who felt prepared to give a talk on Robert La Follette.
Really?
And that blew me, or the history department. Well, I don't do that, period. So, who ended up doing a video on Robert La Follette? I have now about a 25-minute video of myself lecturing on Bob La Follette with pictures from, you know, him standing on stumps and so on. And the fact that that was something that was needed and somebody had to do it, and luckily I had the time and could do it, and the resources are here, there's marvelous stuff. But had somebody, I've been perfectly happy that somebody else do it, but somebody had to do it. And when you are in the academy and you know how to do these kinds of things, there is a call for this sort of service. So that perhaps is a spin on the role of the professor and the thinker, which has struck me especially now as the where the war is going on, and where the misunderstandings are huge has to do with the world of Muslims, which I happen just to have grown up in.
Yes.
So probably, if there's anything that I've spoken on more than anything else in the last 2 years or 3 years, it's been on Islam and Muslims, and how does one interpret what's going on, and how does one address the sort of gross oversimplifications that are being given by why we're doing this thing to Muslims or why Muslims behave as they do, based on wrong information, triggered often by other motives which could be fairly sinister, like wanting to control oil or wanting to have large bases in some part of the world. So you take whatever the facts are, you arrange them in such a way that they try to justify what you're doing.
Do you see intellectuals in America today under more assault than they've ever been? Or is the fact that what intellectuals know, has it historically always been held in disrepute and then acknowledged later?
I'm not sure. Oh, whether they're held in disrepute or not, I find when I'm talking, I'm immensely appreciated. Now, again, it may be self-selected, but as things were beginning to heat up in Afghanistan and Iraq, there were citizens groups that asked me to come out to places like Baraboo or places like Monroe. And there would be 100, 200 people who were hungry to get some sort of information about what had been happening there and to what extent what we were being told would happen was likely to happen. And that's very rewarding because it is just plain information that they're looking for. Because the information being given is either distorted or left out, because you know we have a notion of American superiority, the need to meet Americans' needs and defense and so on, and so you get into all the sorts of things that we have no choice to do, and so we're going to go and do them. So I felt that where I do have a map to show, or data to give, or time sequence, which I usually give with lectures, a sort of a short course in history, that just giving that, which I can give because this is the kind of skill that academics build up, is appreciated, and in a small way may affect how people actually end up behaving. I do lecture to the Foreign Service Institute.
Oh.
5 times a year, I go in to lecture to a group of diplomats who are preparing to go to South Asia.
Huh.
These are Pakistan, Nepal, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka. Now, I don't talk about policy. I'm told not to talk about policy. I'm told you are there to provide them with information. And the two lectures which I give, one is on what is the caste system and how does it work and how does it get into politics and what do you need to understand if you're going to function effectively in a society where caste is a big deal. And the other is on Islam and what does jihad mean and what are the various groups of Muslims in South Asia. And if one is dealing with that part of the world, how do you relate yourself to them and so on. And I think this is a great opportunity for one hand because these are people who many of them will be either making decisions or will be drawing out the reports on which decisions we make. And in each of these, what I try to do, and they probably sense it, is to say these are real people with concepts of the world that make sense. And from the way they look at things, they're acting rationally and even in terms of broad values that we share. And they aren't the ones that we say, well, the only solution is to nuke them or to beat them into submission. Because there is a rationale in the history there to what they're doing that does make sense if you stand on that side of the fence and look at it. So maybe sort of a quiet sort of slipping in there to say, look at them as human beings with a somewhat different take on things. I typically end up my lecture on Islam with jokes about mullahs. Now, most people have the notion that there's this Islamic theocracy and mullahs are telling people remain hidden and don't go out if you don't marry. So, the part of the world in which I grew up has dozens, if not hundreds, of jokes about mullahs, in which you sort of make fun of them. They're nice people, they're trying to be religious, but they're kind of slow-witted.
Oh, really?
And when all is said and done, they're just, It's sort of like, you know, the old rabbi or the old minister. They're sweet people who mean well, but they're not going to tell you to go out and die if in terms of their relationship with the community. And, you know, if it softens the diplomat's view of what the Muslim world is all about, that there are these kind of jokes within the group itself, they say, we don't take ourselves all that seriously. We don't take our mullahs all that seriously. It's a little bit of a sense that these folks are just as human as we are.
You're quite consistent with that theme, aren't you, about we are all human beings.
Right, yeah. If there were that's a string that I keep pulling, I suppose that's it.
That right. Seems to inform much of your work. You have certainly made reference to that.
Right.
What you read about your speech following 9/11, mm-hmm. You talked about suffering in Mexico and Vietnam,
right.
As well as in the United States.
Yeah. And to some extent, the purpose of the Global Cultures course is kind of the same thing. And even the LGBT course is kind of the same thing.
Uh-huh.
These people are all, you know, they differ in some ways, but in most ways, we can be they and they can be us.
That's quite a wonderful statement. So this concludes the tape and the interview. Thank you.